Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Health and Human Services Finance Division to order. We have a quorum, and we have minutes here from February 26, 2020. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Olson moves to approve the minutes of February 26. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. So, members and to the public, we are here today to discuss the state's potential response to the COVID-19 issue. And there have been a number of briefings on this. We have the Department of Health here today, and also the Minnesota Hospital Association has a representative here to just to talk to us a little bit of background about the disease, about the what's happening, and about what may happen here in Minnesota. And then the main thing that we're going to be talking about today is a potential budget item where the Department of Health has a request for funds to go into the special fund that has been established for that purpose. So before we begin, I just wanted to say to members, we're not today going to move the bill out. As you know, we don't have an amendment. What we do have is just I think, a pretty carefully thought through request from the Department of Health, but we're not going to move this out today because there may be still more refinement to that that's going to happen in the near future. And what we want to do is have a hearing on this, talk about the potential request, ask members, ask questions, understand how this could all work, and then come back on another day and with an amendment that puts that into the bill and then move the bill. So the bill that we have today before us, as members are used to seeing, has a blank appropriation in it. Of course, we don't move any bills out of here with a blank appropriation. We're going to fill that in when we understand clearly what is being requested and what we are interested in appropriating for these purposes. So that is what we're doing today. So we have some presentation from Commissioner Malcolm and her staff, and we'll start with that. And I think the best way to proceed on this is some members will be pretty familiar with this already because either you're on the Health and Human Services Policy Committee, which has heard a presentation, or you've heard it elsewhere. But we're trying to bring everybody up to speed on this. And then let's let the commissioner get through her presentation before we ask questions, or at least through the first part of the presentation where she's going to kind of set the table for us. Of course, as always, unless there's something that isn't clear, that you just need a quick clarification in order to understand what's being explained. So with that, Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members. I'm Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you very much for not only your willingness to consider this budget request, but for this time to keep members fully up to date on what we know, and what we're doing in Minnesota on preparation for the COVID-19 disease that has clearly now established itself as a global outbreak. And again, members, some of you have seen this. I'm going to go really quickly through these slides, but I want you to have them as resource materials. Hopefully, for the most part, they're fairly self-explanatory, and we are ready for your questions at any time. This first slide is an already outdated picture of the global spread of the disease and what is happening here in the U.S. I'll go into a little bit more detail on the U.S. But suffice it to say, nobody really can keep up with these numbers anymore. They change several times a day, and as we're starting to see more cases in states in the U.S., the state numbers may be different than the CDC numbers, so it depends on what information source you're looking at what point in time as to what the exact numbers are, but clearly over 92,000 cases and 3,000 deaths globally. As you can see, the majority, great majority still, of the cases and the deaths are still in China, but the spread is clearly growing now faster in countries outside of China. I will come, I'll just go right to the next slide on the state perspective, what's happening in the U.S. In addition to the cases that had been identified and monitored over the last several weeks from either Americans who had been in China and came back or people who had direct contact with those people and now repatriating citizens from where they had been, including on the cruise ship. That's sort of the backdrop. What's been dramatically happening in the last just number of days, literally, is what we're seeing is community spread in an increasing number of states. The total, as of now, is 60 total deaths. 60 total cases, 6 deaths. Chris Ayersman may have even updated numbers from beyond these numbers. Washington State has a number of cases in a skilled nursing facility, which gives us obviously great concern about making sure we're doing enough preparation in long-term care facilities here. We have seen healthcare workers becoming infected, and travel restrictions and advisories continue to expand. This next chart, and perhaps before I'll just continue on, and then we'll get into Minnesota more specifically. Folks have asked, how infectious is this compared to other diseases? There is a kind of a critical tool in epidemiology, the basic reproduction number known as R-naught, to help us predict how quickly a disease is going to spread in a population. Basically, if the R-naught is less than 1, the disease typically, if one person doesn't even infect one more person or only one more person, that the disease typically dies out, does not evolve into a full-blown outbreak. But an R-naught larger than 1 means that each sick person is infecting more than at least one other person, but more than other person, who then can go on to infect another person or more than one. That's when you get the geometric progression of these numbers. So what we know so far for COVID-19 is that R-naught, reproduction number, appears to be between 2 and 3, which puts it in the category of something that is expected to continue to grow. And I should also just underscore everything I'm saying is what we know so far and is preliminary, because there's so much that yet that we don't know about the validity of some of the numbers that are coming out of other countries. It's very much in flux. The other key question, how serious, how lethal is COVID-19 compared to other diseases with which we have some familiarity? And you can see here on this chart that, again, what we know or think as of now is that the estimated case fatality for COVID-19 as a general overall population average is 2.3%, which is quite a bit higher than seasonal flu, which is 0.1%. Again, this is in the general population. That 2.3 number might fall as more and more cases are detected, so that the denominator grows significantly as more cases of disease are detected. But at present, from the case counts and the fatalities, it's at 2.3%. SARS, 10%, MERS, 30%, Ebola, 50%. So we've certainly seen infectious diseases in fairly recent memory that are much more lethal than COVID-19 at this point. Important to underscore, though, that these average case fatality rates differ a great deal by demography, by age, and by the severity of illness. So what we know about the illness out of China has something that they call their CDC, and that's an actual picture of it. It has no connection to our CDC. It's just what they've named their institution. Out of the Chinese data, 81% of the cases have been mild, non-pneumonia cases, or very mild pneumonia. 14% of the cases have been severe, more severe respiratory distress, lower oxygen saturation, rapidly developing lung infiltrates that can be seen clinically. 5% of patients have severe enough disease to be admitted to the ICU, and the mortality rate for people who end up in the ICU is quite a bit higher, approaching 50%. So when the disease is severe, it can be quite severe. Much higher mortality rates in the elderly and in those with underlying health conditions. So we can unpack that 2.3% number by different population groups. This next is a chart of influenza activity in Minnesota this season. This is important for a couple reasons. It shows you, you know, kind of how the regular seasonal flu evolves in the state in terms of the growth in numbers, a dip, and then a second wave. We are still in widespread flu season, almost 3,000 hospitalizations to date, including 72 deaths, two of them among children. That's important context just for us to remember that flu is something we deal with every year, and it's serious, and it creates lots of hospitalization and significant numbers of deaths. That I also mention that just to remind you that in healthcare and public health, this is what we do. We manage outbreaks all the time, and influenza is an outbreak in any given year. Gives us it underscores the importance of emergency preparedness and management of surges like this as just a normal course of business for healthcare and public health. However, also to point out that we're in the midst of flu season, and you will hear from the providers, I'm sure you already have, they're full. They're very full. So the concern is the prospect of another outbreak on top of flu coming into our system at a time when it's already running at full capacity. This chart is, I think, a very helpful visual to not only explain how really what we're trying to do in managing this. The dark purple chart there is what happens in an outbreak, a pandemic outbreak, with no successful intervention. This is the kind of rapid growth in cases that you see hitting the healthcare system all at the same time. What we saw in China is when the system gets overwhelmed. What we're really trying to do is the smaller curve at the bottom with the shaded area is to slow down and spread out the disease. So it's not about saying, well, if we can't stop it, it's game over. It's we expect it to come, and the goal is to slow it down and spread it out so that it can be managed by the healthcare system and its impact on society is more able to be managed without undue disruption. This next chart just describes, and the page after that in your handout, kind of that the fact that at these different phases of a pandemic, which again we know what to expect, we know how pandemics evolve, and we know what kinds of interventions are most useful at different points in the pandemic, that we've been and are in a containment mode, and I'm going to switch now to the definition of these terms. So containment is when we're dealing with just a handful of cases. And when the first case is identified in Minnesota, we will focus on isolation of the person who is ill, contact identification, who has that person been in contact with, and seeking voluntary quarantine of those people who've had exposure to the infected case. That's what we'll do when we have a handful of cases. That's what we've been doing when we have people who present with not only symptoms, but travel histories to China or contact with people with those travel histories. So we've been doing this approach to containment and to working with individuals for several weeks now. However, when we start to see multiple cases from different areas of the state or multiple cases from different means of exposure, so some that are exposed by contact with an ill person, that's explainable. But when you start to see, as Washington State has seen, and other states, cases where you can't identify where the exposure came from, and we start to see multiples of those, that's when we consider ourselves to be in a different phase of the epidemic, and when community mitigation measures are really what's indicated, where it really encourage serious consideration of postponement of large community events, considering temporary school closings if that's where the exposure is happening, and promoting as much virtual interaction as possible in commerce, in business, and in faith services, et cetera. When we get to the point where we're seeing hundreds or thousands, or if we get to the point, I should say, when we're seeing hundreds or thousands of cases across the state, then frankly, we are in a resource management situation where the job is really to make sure that the resources get to the people who most need them, that we're just not in a situation where we expect business as usual to be the mode of operation in our systems. So what we're currently doing, both at the federal level and in the states, is a dual approach. We're still working on containment, and we'll continue to work with individuals as they present, but also to begin, we've been planning and having the conversations about what community mitigation measures are available and most suited to different situations. But we're really in encouraging businesses and others to think about and do planning about what their community mitigation measures will be, both for their own interest, but also as part of the community response to helping to prevent the spread of disease. All about slowing transmission, minimizing mortality, minimizing the impact on the healthcare system and our infrastructure as a state, but also really preserving the healthcare resources for the people for whom they're going to make the critical difference, that fairly small subset of patients with severe disease where medical interventions are really necessary and can be life-saving. So what we've been doing, we've been progressively increasing our planning activities and our communication activities. So For probably 6 weeks now, we've had regular communications between MDH and local public health so that we're sharing information and all working off of the same data, the same guidance from CDC, the same messages, and the same strategies in terms of engaging our communities. Joint Information Center is kind of a communications hub tool. Doing that with local public health for quite a while. We just this week have activated a joint information center for state agencies where the communications staff from each state agency are in daily contact, again, to make sure that we're sharing information, key messages, and that all state agencies are really working with their constituencies to get accurate information out and to be able to prepare their various constituencies with accurate information and consistent messages, because we've seen how confusing it is when the messages are different. We also have begun a unified coordination system where emergency management staff from each state agency are in frequent contact to, again, just coordinate planning activities. That is one step short of activating the State Emergency Operations Center. So we've not done that, but this unified coordination structure is kind of the step below that that will enable us to have a real running start at the Emergency Operations Center if we find ourselves in a situation with growing numbers of cases dispersed throughout the state. The Department of Administration is implementing enhanced cleaning protocols for the Capitol and other state buildings to do what we can do with our public spaces to take best guidance from the CDC on advanced cleaning protocols. At the State Health Department, we've been working, as I've said, on containment and are expanding to thinking about mitigation strategies. Our closest partners in local public health are doing a lot of work thinking about this and talking with their local healthcare systems and others. We've been working with clinicians to identify and evaluate patients who may have COVID-19, and we've been getting lots and lots of calls from providers. That's exactly what we want. There's lots of consultation going on daily between our staff and providers who are wondering, you know, what to do with any given patient with certain clinical symptoms or certain potential exposure routes. I'm happy to tell you that the Public Health Laboratory in Minnesota now has the capability to do testing in Minnesota. That just we were up and running Monday morning with that. Prior to that time, any suspect cases or persons under investigation who met these specific criteria from the CDC, we needed to send those samples down to CDC and would get responses back from them 48, 72, something like that, hours later. And we did send a number of potential of persons under investigation. Those cases, I think we sent a total of five down to CDC before we had our own testing capacity. We've now able to do that at our state lab. We've tested, I believe, 9 persons under investigation so far ourselves, all negative to this point. More cases will be coming in every day. That's what we expect. That's what we're looking for, is for providers to be sending us samples from anyone who meets those criteria or is or can't be ruled out for other things. We're working very closely with hospitals, clinics, long-term care facilities on their planning and making sure that we are communicating with each other and understanding who's doing what with respect to planning. There is a structure known as a healthcare coalition, which has a specific meaning in preparedness terminology. We have 8 coalitions around the state in 8 geographic regions where the local public health and the healthcare systems and long-term care are meeting together regularly to coordinate emergency plans and to be able to share information on current capacity and to have conversations about how capacity might be shared. So those regional coalitions are a really key part of the preparedness system and our management system as well. We have convened within the health department teams of people who can be called on to think about community mitigation recommendations in light of specific circumstances that an employer, a school, a community may be encountering, so that we can give them the best evidence-based recommendations we can about community mitigation strategies. A particular focus has been schools, lots of activity, and it will increase even further with the Department of Education and the Office of Higher Ed to make sure we're getting best information possible out to schools, both for mitigation, for prevention, making sure that we're educating people in every way possible about personal protective actions to be taken, but also so that those institutions are thinking about mitigation, community mitigation strategies as well. And again, we just can't say it often enough that those standard measures to protect ourselves from respiratory infections that we deal with as a normal matter, of course, every year also apply to COVID-19. This is a coronavirus. A third of common colds are caused by one or another type of coronavirus. The same precautions that work for flu and work for other coronaviruses are applicable here. Probably the single most important thing we can do to try to prevent community spread is for people to stay home when they are sick, to not expose others, whether that's a regular respiratory infection or potentially COVID-19. Preventing that community spread by each of us taking that responsibility very seriously is important. We understand that that's easier said than done for a lot of people, and that's part of the planning work we need to do and part of the conversation we need to have is how do we make that, how do we work with employers to make that as real an option as possible for people. Just stressing the importance of that, not only for the health of the worker and the workers right around that worker, but as a key component of community mitigation as well. Covering your cough, not with your bare hands, but with a handkerchief or using the crook of your elbow to cough or sneeze into, really important. Washing your hands thoroughly and more frequently than usual. The virus can live on surfaces, so it's just a good idea to wash your hands often during the day and to avoid touching your face, especially your eyes, nose, and mouth. These are the real basics, but they are actually highly effective to protect people, what people can do for themselves, not only to protect themselves, but to protect our family and our neighbors. It's just the case, the fact that most of us are not going to be in high-risk categories, but we all have a duty to try to protect the vulnerable people in our community for whom the spread of this illness is a much higher risk and a much more serious concern. We are trying to make it as easy as we can for people to get access to current credible information from the CDC, and from our own experts at MDH. The websites are an excellent way to keep track of current guidance, current information about the situation, best recommendations for different different types of facilities, different types of environments, and just again focusing, you know, it's so important that people know what are the real risks, what are not the real risks, what can people do to protect themselves, and how can we help to protect each other through these community strategies. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to address the resource question, unless you would like to take some questions on this background.
Yeah, thank you, Commissioner. I do have a couple of members with questions. If those are questions about the background material, we could take them now before we go to the fiscal part of this hearing. And before we do that, too, I just wanted to point out to members that we've given you in your packets a copy of the public health response contingency account language. And this is the account into which we would be proposing to put some additional funding that would be available for the department's use. And I wanted to give this to you because it is very specific. I think this was enacted in 2017, if I'm not mistaken, so some of you might be familiar with it already, but it really I think lays out pretty well the kinds of uses that the money could be put toward. So anyway, with that, I would go to Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Malcolm. I know that this is a tremendous undertaking, so I really appreciate your attention, the department's attention, to ensuring that we mitigate the potential outbreak of COVID-19 in the state of Minnesota. I just had a couple of questions, and I apologize if these are premature given the available information we have on COVID-19, but do we know of a more frequent mode of transmission? Do we know, is it likely to hang in the air? Is it likely to stay on surfaces longer? Just kind of as a understanding question.
All right, thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Cantrell, I would like to ask our infectious disease director, Chris Ayersman, to help me answer some of these specific questions.
Okay.
I think the answer is we do know something about transmission in the ways in which this is similar to other coronaviruses.
Yeah, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. So, Madam Chair, my name is Chris Ayersman. I'm the director for infectious disease at the Minnesota Department of Health. And so, Representative Cantrell, yes, we know there's many things we don't know. But what we do know about this virus is that when the commissioner showed you the graphic about infectiousness, we know that it's not nearly as infectious as something like measles, which has airborne spread, which means it can hang in the air for a fair amount of time, up to 2 hours after someone who's had the virus, you know, goes past. That's not the case, and it's not our understanding right now with this virus. And so our current recommendations, for instance, for healthcare are for standard and respiratory precautions. So that's focusing on droplet spread, you know, arm's length or a little bit farther, 6 feet away. So that's how we're looking at the spread. And then as the commissioner also mentioned, surfaces can be an issue. And so that's why we're telling people, you know, be careful if you're touching things, if you're out in public, wash your hands a lot, don't touch your face. Not because it's the primary mode of transmission, but because it is a potential mode of transmission. So we just want people to be aware.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Director Ayersman. My one other kind of question was, does the department, does the state have a plan for how to address, you know, the potential? Because I know that as I think a lot of folks know, that the numbers that we have available to us already is just the data that we have available to us. So it's really a snapshot of potentially kind of folks who might have an aversion to, or it doesn't include folks who have an aversion to seeing their physician, who otherwise don't have access to those resources. I was listening to NPR the other day, and I believe actually, Director Ayersman, you were in that interview, and it indicated in the interview that that folks still do have to pay for their medical visits, and I'm not asking for a solution to that. I'm just wondering if the department is kind of starting to think of ways to kind of engage in, I know you touched on some outreach options, but especially among patient populations who either have an aversion to visiting a physician for financial or other reasons, so that we can make sure that, we have that kind of comprehensive approach to, mitigating potential outbreak in Minnesota.
So, Representative Cantrell, I think you might be sort of anticipating for the whole rest of the hearing here.
Oh, my apologies,
so,
Chair.
To a degree. So that's great. It kind of sets it all up. But I think rather than, because I think it's kind of, Dr. Erisman, if you want to respond, it's fine. But, I mean, I think it's kind of bound up with the request for funding. So maybe we should, it's up to you. If you want to try to respond briefly, that's fine, or we can put it off and talk about it in terms of resources.
Madam Chair and Representative Cantrell, it's an excellent question, and it definitely is an issue that we're talking about because access to care is a significant issue. During the pandemic of 2009-10, we did have a nurse triage line that was an effective way to provide information to people who had questions about symptoms. We have not moved in that direction at this point, but I think your concerns about individuals who don't have access to care in this kind of situation is an important one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr.
Thank you. Commissioner, did you want to add anything?
I think not at this time.
Okay. So members, I have on the list now Munson, Keel, Halverson. And again, I would say that let's keep our questions right now to sort of the basic issue because we're going to talk more deeply about the funding, potential funding, which kind of goes more into the department's plans. But Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Malcolm, thanks for the presentation. I shared with Chair Liebling yesterday my experience with the Department of Health, and I think it was 2003 during the SARS outbreak. I worked for a large Canadian bank and spent time in Toronto and happened to be during the outbreak and came back and I had a fever of 103 for like 3 days, and my employer said I couldn't come to work unless I had a note from the doctor saying I didn't have SARS. And so I called my local doctor, and they called the Department of Health, and they mobilized. I guess I was the first suspected case of SARS in Minnesota. And I had to go to the HCMC, where I sat in a negative pressure room for a Wuhan. I went to a negative pressure room and sat for, 6 hours while they did all these tests and, basically cleared me to go back to work once my fever broke. But I was really impressed at how organized they were and working with the CDC on managing that outbreak because I think it's important to be prepared, and it sounds like they were at that time, and it sounds like you were very prepared today. I just had a quick question on your presentation, and I'm sorry I was a few minutes late, but when you talk about the 2.3% mortality rate, I think one of the conversations that's come up a lot during this outbreak is just the seasonal flu numbers, and people are so shocked to learn that, 12 to 61,000 Americans die every year from seasonal flu. And they suspect that I think it was between 20 and 45 million Americans are infected with the seasonal flu each year. And that's kind of just based on all the people that get flu and don't go to the doctor. They kind of divide the numbers and come up with that really low rate of 0.1% of mortality rate. But your number for 2.3, is that people that visit a doctor? And then, is that how they're coming up with the high mortality rate?
Dr. Erisman?
I'm sorry.
It's been a long week already for Chris.
I know. Chairman Liebling and Representative Munson. Those data come from a case series report from the China CDC, and so it's based on 44,000 individuals who were diagnosed with confirmed COVID-19, and so that's where that's coming from. So it's very China-centric, and that's why Commissioner Malcolm indicated that we expect to see these numbers change because we don't know how many additional mild cases were not identified, and as we see disease occurring in other parts of the world, that will help to inform that. But that's based on 44,000 confirmed cases from China.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't mean to go off script here a little bit, but I've got a little concern about how we identify. As some of you know, my husband got Legionnaires last year, and of course that was through particulates in the air that he got that. And the initial signs were that he had the flu, just lethargic, didn't feel well. It wasn't until 3 days later, 3-4 days later, that he couldn't breathe anymore and his lungs had filled with fluid. And while that's not the same as a contagious disease, because otherwise I'd have been sick too, it is a little different. But my concern is that we're telling people to, you know, stay home if they don't feel well. And so how are they able to decipher exactly how sick or what they need to be looking at? Because, you know, in our personal case, I would not have guessed that this is where this was going the first couple days. I mean, it just seemed to me like, yeah, get some rest, drink a lot of fluids, you'll be fine type of thing. And then now we're looking at this type of an illness that actually is quite it's respiratory also, correct? Mm-hmm. And I, you know, you can go from bad to worse really quickly.
Okay, Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Keel, you're right, and I think I'd certainly invite Chris to add in here, but I think the basic guidance, you know, for patients and to providers to help counsel their patients is to be vigilant when you have a respiratory illness, that it requires self-care and it requires monitoring of fever, and if respiratory symptoms get worse, that's when the doctor wants to hear from you. And so I think it's a similar kind of guidance here. You're right. And that's part of what makes this tricky, is that the symptoms are not readily distinguishable from a cold or a seasonal flu, which is kind of where some of the questions have come around what is the right regimen for testing or the right criteria for testing, so we not under-detect potentially. And I think the Washington case example has been really, really instructive there, that they apparently had the virus and the disease circulating in their community for some amount of time before it was detected. So it's going to be a challenge and important to be able to test patients who have symptoms that are progressing and can't be ruled out for other reasons, as Chris has suggested. But I think it might not be a terribly satisfying answer, but just the same, and I know there will be some physicians testifying, and you could certainly ask this question of them too, but I think that the initial screening and management of folks with respiratory illness is a pretty well-established protocol, and they know what to look for in terms of increasing severity.
Okay, Ms. Ayersman.
Madam Chair and Representative Keel, thank you for those comments, and you make a good point, and I'll make sure our messaging has been that, you know, if you feel you need to seek health care, that we want you to do that. And so the stay home when you're sick is sort of stay home, don't go to, you know, optional activities, don't go to work. But you make a good point, and I'll make sure that we're being sensitive to the fact that we don't want people to think that our message is stay home and don't seek health care, because that's not it. We just want to make sure that you're not going to that hockey game or not going to that other event if you're ill. So I appreciate that.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to point out too, you know, it doesn't take very long at all. There's more professional medical people here that understand that. But I will tell you, the minute people start having trouble breathing, their mental capacity goes down, and they do not seek what they need to seek at the time because they're not clear. My husband told my son that if he felt like this tomorrow, they could go to the doctor. Fortunately, my son had the wherewithal to say, no, Dad, you either have a pickup ride or a ambulance ride, but going to the hospital. And we believe that we would have found him probably dead had he stayed home that night. But the important part about this COVID-19 is the air the oxygen level that is so damaging right away that you're not getting, and so then we are not clear. So just very concerned that people seek. Ask that question right away, because even in our case, the Legionnaires, had the doctor not had the wherewithal to check it right away, there would have been a lag time there also, but he happened to just jump on it right away. In fact, his staff kind of gave him a hard time about, oh, you think everybody's got that. And so they were all shocked when it was identified, and he wasn't the only one. But it just is really important that we address it immediately so we're not spreading it and seeking the help so we can get on top of it right away. Thank you.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was watching the press conference from my doctor's office with my son, who was in to get tested for flu after his mom had it last week. So getting to care is certainly important. But what was interesting to me was when the doctor came in and I'm watching this press conference. I said, I'm watching the COVID-19 press conference. And she said, the Today Show this morning said that if you have any symptoms, you have to go directly to your primary care office. And she indicated that there's an important role in this particular outbreak for the Department of Health, so that we make sure that we're not putting people into places where they can infect other people. And so I guess I was looking for a little bit more advice along the lines of what Representative Keel was asking for, of how we manage this and get people the care that they need in the proper settings, and that people are making the right phone calls and going to the right places so that we're not unnecessarily exposing other people. She raised that concern, and I think I could use more advice about it myself, and would love to share that with others.
Okay. Did you want to respond to that, Commissioner, at all?
Madam Chair, Representative Halverson and Representative Keel, I think, make good points that the more specific we can get with our guidance, the more helpful. Not the general statements perhaps not as helpful as some more specifics about, you know, if this, then that. And Chris made mention of the fact that we have in the past had like nurse triage lines, or I don't know that we're to the point of saying this, but saying call us before you call your doctor. But I think we want to be an extra resource, and there really is no substitute for astute clinicians to help assess severity and appropriateness of treatment path. They really are the right ones to do that. But what can we do to avoid swamping that system, or to avoid unnecessary transmission of disease in healthcare settings is always an appropriate thing. But I take your message to heart that the more specific we can be about when to seek care where, the better.
So, members, I now have three on the list. We're never going to get to the fiscal part of this, and we did have a full hearing in policy. I know not all of you are on that committee, but I'm going to quickly go to the two members that were already on the list, and then I'm going to go to the next part of the hearing, if that's okay, and we can see if we have time at the end for more sort of general questions, if that's all right. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. What kind of outreach has the Department of Health done across languages and to other diverse communities in Minnesota? I know I've seen a lot of work being done in English, and I want to make sure that we're taking care of all Minnesotans. And what's being done to make sure that we're translating and reaching across cultural communities?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is a great question, and that's increasingly important that we get materials translated. We do, and don't know that I can answer the question specifically about which materials have been translated into which languages, but that's an important branch of the outreach activities, and reaching out to specific communities and specific community leaders to understand what are the questions, what are the kinds of things that they may need in addition to the generic material, which is just a translation matter. We also know we have to be culturally appropriate and in context. So working with the faith communities and community leaders and organizations serving communities to make sure that we're getting that more tailored messaging out to them is a very critical part of the strategy. I can follow up with you on more specifics about what's already been translated.
That would be great. Okay. Thank you.
And all right, Representative Wilson.
Mine will be after.
Oh. Well, we're going to go, you know, unless you, if you have something on the policy.
Madam Chair, mine was more on the fiscal part and the after. So once all is done.
Excellent. Yep. Okay. We're going to go right now to the fiscal part of this. And go through that, and then we can always circle back and ask. I mean, we could easily, obviously, spend the entire hearing talking about kind of these kinds of issues, which are very, very important. But we do need to make sure. So, Representative Grunhagen, if you can wait till we circle back, sure, that would be great if it's kind of on the general policy. So, so Commissioner, if you would then, we have a, in our packets here, we have a budget proposal. And if you would want to walk us through that proposal and make any comments related to that, be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So, Madam Chair already drew your attention to a description of the public health emergency response account, which already exists. We have today initiated a request to access the existing balance in that account so that we can free up some funds. I want to just remind you of something that we covered in our budget overview just a few weeks ago with you. In the entirety of the health department's budget, about half of our funding comes from the federal government, and only 20% comes from the general fund itself. So we don't have a lot of general fund money that we can reallocate. And federal dollars are very restrictive to the specific type of work or specific disease or condition that those federal dollars are to work on. So we are requesting access to the existing account to help cover the work that's already going on, and we are requesting an additional appropriation of an additional just under $21 million for preparation and response to what we are to be ready. So what we think we would need for a year's worth of health department and local public health activities around communication, investigation, and response activities. I want to be really clear at the outset that this budget that we have prepared really is about the public health component of the activities. This budget does not include funding for hospitals, clinics, long-term care systems related to patient care or related to increasing capacity for patient care. And you will hear from them directly about that. I just want to be clear that this is kind of the state and local agency component of this plan. We do know a lot about, based on prior epidemics and the work that we do as a routine matter. A lot of the data that I'm going to share with you is based on kind of projections that are based off of what we learned from H1N1. And as Chris has said many a time, every outbreak is different, every infectious agent is a little bit different, but it gives us a relevant point of departure, I think. So with respect to staffing, we anticipate that we will need about 100 full-time equivalent staff for the COVID-19 response. And again, this is a budget for a year, so to get us through to when we're back together in the next legislative session. I want to be clear that these are not 100 new staff. These are existing health department staff who are already doing their work but are funded on other federal funds that cannot be used for this purpose. So these staff need to be redeployed to this emergency activity, but there's no funding to cover their time for doing this work. So that's what this is about. I just want to be clear, we're not talking about hiring 100 new people. We're talking about paying for the 100 people who are already doing the work. So we've been tracking how that staffing need is ramping up. For instance, during the peak of the measles outbreak, we had 70 full-time equivalent staff working on that response. We predict that we may have about 130 full-time equivalent staff working on this response during the peak of this outbreak, just based on the disease prevalence numbers we've seen from China and elsewhere and H1N1. The only new staffing in this complement, it would be to contract for additional medical expertise at the department. In the laboratory, based on the testing trends that we've seen during previous outbreaks, we assume that testing will start off slow at about 100 samples per week and ramp up to about 300 samples per week. And you see there the data about what that yields on an annual basis and the cost of testing, which our expectation here is those tests will not be billed out to the clinics or hospitals that are sending the cases to us. but that would be funded through the laboratory's operations. Additionally, genetic sequencing on certain samples, just as a way of helping us to be more precise on determining how cases are related to each other, and adding that to the national knowledge on this topic is an additional cost. So you can see there that the staffing part of the ask is just over $10 million, the lab just under $1.7 million. And then local public health really is so critical. I mean, they are closest to the action. They're on the ground. We have in the past allocated resources based on the location of the outbreak, but we're assuming here that all community health boards and tribal governments, tribal health departments, will need resources to be able to respond. So we've made some assumptions here about numbers of staff needed based on the size of the community health board, its population, and its geographic region. So we've made some estimates there. So this would be $8.5 million in grants for added staffing to local public health and tribal health. I mentioned before the importance of healthcare coalitions, those planning entities that exist as a permanent basis. These aren't things we turn up and turn down, but those healthcare coalitions are always working to coordinate preparedness activities among the healthcare systems in the regions. We assume that each coalition could use one additional full-time equivalent staff just for working on COVID-19 communications and coordination amongst their local healthcare systems. So $800,000 for increased staffing to the healthcare coalitions. Again, this is not the same thing as direct resources to the healthcare providers for patient care. Personal protective equipment. During the H1N1 outbreak, the strategic national stockpile was extremely important, and this was a major source of the resources that the provider systems directly got, was through the national stockpile. And you can through that stockpile, Minnesota purchased and received over 2,000,095 masks and surgical masks for providers. And we estimated that the healthcare systems will require perhaps $40 million in PPE, which would hopefully be accessed through that strategic national stockpile. But this ask here is for personal protective equipment for health department staff, for those who are monitoring patients, conducting in disease investigations, and also for those who will continue to conduct regulatory functions that can't be postponed, such as nursing home and assisted living inspections and investigations. Department of Public Safety has also given us an estimate for what they think personal protective equipment for local and state law enforcement would be. So that personal protective equipment estimate is for a little over $4 million, but again, that is not anticipating the full PPE need for the healthcare system, which would presumably be fulfilled by the national stockpile. So that is an outline of what we've identified, and just kind of broken down not by the specific tasks that we do, but kind of the category of, is it staffing, is it laboratory, is it PPE? But I think it's, again, just to be abundantly clear, we have not yet asked, the governor has asked all departments to be thinking about the implications of COVID-19 to their operations and needs, and he'll be getting that input from them and possibly considering that in the context of his budget recommendations. This is really very specific to MDH, local public health, and those healthcare coalitions, and I hope that that's clear.
Yes, thank you very much, Commissioner. And I just want to make a statement, too, around that, or ask you the question. You know, we're going to now hear in a few minutes from the Hospital Association about what they're doing. But if there are other budgetary requests, and I assume that there will be from other players in the system, my inclination would be to say they should go through the Department of Health to be coordinated, to be considered, and to be brought to us as one system-wide request. I don't know that we legislators are in such a good position to be kind of doing some over here and some over here. I think it needs to be a very coordinated. So I just wanted to ask you, Commissioner, is that kind of how you would prefer to this to happen? Because I'm just afraid that, you know, otherwise we'll have different players in the system who all may have very legitimate requests, you know, kind of lobbying members and members not knowing how to prioritize those kinds of asks.
Madam Chair, I appreciate your thinking about how can we best coordinate what could otherwise be kind of a confusing and set of requests coming at the legislature. Yeah, I do think that we're happy to be involved in those conversations with the providers about how we think about resource needs and resource sharing across the system, what we need on a temporary basis, what we need on a permanent basis. I think there are a complex number of questions, but we're absolutely willing and ready and already in some degree of dialogue with the providers on that question.
Okay, very good. So I have a list of members with questions. I have, let me just tell everybody, Grunhagen, Olson, Schultz, Mann, Schumacher, and Knorr. And we still do want to hear from the Hospital Association. So Representative Grunhagen, oh, did he leave? Okay. All right, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for doing this hearing today. I think this is timely and important to the Commissioner in putting the request together so that we don't hopefully need to have any sort of special session and that the resources are there and that the Governor has the ability to act in ways that the Governor may need to act. And my question was a little bit along the lines, but I think Chair Liebling was really helpful in thinking through about how resources are getting out to the places that need them. But around thinking about the local public health, I think you had mentioned this would be grant funding and how quickly it could get through a process to get on the ground with the people in greater Minnesota and tribal governments that need it, that kind of process, just to make sure it could be quick and ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, thank you. Speed is important, and what I'm asking Margaret Kelly to join me at the table just so she can address some of those questions. But we do have a number of obviously just deep relationships with local public health and possibly, you know, mechanisms that we can tap into that don't require a whole de novo grant program to be set up.
Yeah, Ms. Kelly, please state your name.
Margaret Kelly, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Health, and I apologize. Can you repeat your question?
No problem, Madam Chair. Yes, so the question was mentioning with the local public health funding that their grant process, but how quickly could we get funds out on the ground to public health entities and tribal governments that would need this funding in order to enact this piece of the budget?
Thank you, Chair and members. We have existing relationships and contracts with local public health, and we would be able to amend those contracts relatively quickly to get the money out the door.
All right, thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. So it sounds like the federal government is going to appropriate $8.3 million dollars? Billion dollars, thank you. Billion dollars to this effort. And I'm just wondering how this would affect your request and what you think the state may receive and how they may allocate that appropriation to the states. And will it be based on need or expected needs? And my other question is, you're requesting $21 million. That is for supplies, antibiotics, other resources or IT resources we may need, but not any salary or FTE?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, first on our request here, no, it's actually kind of the reverse. It's for staffing and equipment and laboratory capacity, but not for medical supplies. For the care systems. So, and with respect to the federal funds, we are just hearing this that as well, that they've reached some agreement at the congressional level. Association of State and Territorial Health Officers in DC has been trying to get some insight into what's in that package. So far we have no information on what's intended or envisioned for states, either via the Strategic National Stockpile, which I referenced earlier, or other ways that the federal government might be supporting providers, but there's not a great track record of federal funding supporting public health preparedness activities such as these. But certainly, and the good thing about the way the fund is designed is that if there is federal funding that comes in that's applicable to these purposes, the emergency account gets repaid from those federal funds first. So to the extent this ends up to be duplicative of anything that we get from the federal government, that would be returned to the state. But certainly in terms of speed, we would just very much appreciate the ability, you know, with the existing fund and hopefully with an increased appropriation, that we'd be able to do what we need to do to get this work happening without waiting for the federal funding to make its way to us.
Thank you.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, thank you for your presentation today. I really appreciate the way you presented it and just the information that you were able to provide there. I did have a question on the staffing piece alone, and this is probably a better question for when we're not in the middle of this, but where do the staff come from for something like this? We hear about a workforce shortage all the time. We know that other states are going to be preparing the same way. Is this more that some people are just going to have overtime and they're doing their regular job and then this on top? Are they being just pulled from separate areas? Or where do you find all the people to help with this? Thank you.
Great Madam question. Chair, Representative Schumacher, yes, these are existing staff. So with very few exceptions, these are people who are currently funded on other federal grants, but those federal grants cannot be used to pay for this work. So we are pulling people off of other less urgent tasks right now to do this work. So this is really about covering staff time rather than buying new staff capacity. Now, what's going to happen to some of that other work, it's going to be slowed down and potentially some of those federal funds will either be extended and expended over a longer period of time, or conceivably, returned to the feds if the grant or contract was not able to be fulfilled because of this reallocation to COVID. But we can't spend those federal dollars this way.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much, Commissioner. The question that I have is similar to Representative Jordan. I don't see any resources allocated in terms of outreach to, you know, trusted agencies. I don't see resources in terms of the language need, in terms of reaching out to every community and making sure that we do have an effective way of communicating with all our constituents in terms of what's happening, how do we update them. So I don't see that resource request in this bill. So how do we go about that?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, thank you. This is not a very detailed budget or a fiscal note with the level of detail that you would see. And we lumped a bunch of things under staffing, but that's not just the staffing for the epidemiologists and the research scientists. That's staffing for communicators and for community engagement work. But you're right. I mean, there would, in addition to people, there would be costs of communication and engagement, which we can break out separately for you.
Representative Noor?
Madam Chair, how soon are you anticipating in terms of communicating with different community entities so that you can have the information out there?
Commissioner. Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative, Chris can add more detail there, but that work, that community outreach and community engagement work is already going on. So all the work that we're describing is already in process, but needs to be sustained and needs to be able to be funded. So Chris can give you a little more detail on the kinds of community outreach and community-specific communications that we're doing now.
And maybe we could do that offline. Would that be okay, Representative?
I'll do it.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gruenhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple quick questions. Thanks for your presentation, too, and the work that you're doing on this. So it seems like, and I've been following a little bit as far as the articles and stuff that have been published, but it seems like the population that is most at risk is like the 55 and older that already have additional health problems. That seems to be where most of the fatalities happen, according to what I've read. You know, so is there, with the money that we're going to give you, are you using it to target like hospitals, nursing homes, and those types of areas where, you know, people of that age bracket would be populated in?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, Yes, and. I mean, I think there are things we need to do for the whole population to help educate and to help, you know, reduce community transmission from younger people who would have a less severe case of the disease still can transmit the disease to folks at higher risk. So you're right. It has to be both the broad community strategies, but intensively focused on planning and mitigation efforts in care settings where we know there's a higher concentration of people who are at risk. And that's what we've learned from Washington. This virus, if given the opportunity to spread in a community, can spread rapidly. We saw that on the cruise ship. We see that in the nursing home in Seattle. So we know it's very important to work with our long-term care facilities on infection control and preventive actions that can be taken, as well as very focused responses that might be needed in those care settings.
Just a follow-up, Madam Chair?
Yeah, thank you. And before you go on, I just point out to members, there is a letter from the long-term care imperative in your packets as well. Go ahead, okay, Representative Grimhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and this is kind of you see a lot of people walking around in the airports and stuff with these face masks on. Now, I happen to know somebody who works with 3M, and he just told me that they just sold all of them and they got sent over to China. You know, just from his perspective, and that was just an average working person, not a supervisor or anything. But is that effective in any way of, you know, because you see some people walking around with it and some not. Is that effective in protecting yourself?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, could I ask Chris to answer?
Ms. Ehrsman.
Madam Chair and Representative, our recommendation at this point is for the general public that face masks are not a useful tool. And in fact, we want to make sure that we are reserving masks and personal protective equipment for our healthcare workers. That's sort of our number one priority, to make sure that they are staying healthy. I do want to acknowledge that there are different kinds of masks, and so sometimes you'll see pictures of people and they're wearing kind of a looser mask. It's a surgical mask, and those are not necessarily helpful in preventing someone from being exposed to a disease. But in healthcare settings, they're often used. You come into the provider, you've called ahead and said, you know, I'm sick, I've got a cold, and to Representative Halverson's concern about how we, you know, kind of keep from sharing this when people are going into the doctor's office, they will often ask you to put on a mask. And the intent of that is so that you aren't spreading disease to others. There are N95 masks and respirators, and those are oftentimes used by individuals who have immunosuppressive conditions. Their healthcare provider recommends that they use that. And it's not during COVID-19, it's just any time. And so those are appropriate use of masks. But for the general public at this point, that's not something that we're recommending. It's not effective. And we want to make sure that any masks that are available for use in the healthcare system.
All right. I'm going to go to Representative Jordan, and then we're going to go to the Hospital Association. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have some questions about how you arrived at some of the numbers based on testing. Where did you arrive at the numbers for 100 samples per week starting off and then 300 as a peak? That seems a little low based on what we're seeing coming out of South Korea and China. Do you know where that came from?
Ms. Ehrsman?
Madam Chair and Representative, what that's based on is the fact that we anticipate that when Commissioner Malcolm showed you that curve of containment, community mitigation, pandemic management, obviously, we're testing now. We have not yet seen a case in Minnesota. There will come a point when we do have cases, and we'll continue to monitor that. But then, once we start to see widespread activity, not every single individual with disease will be tested or needs to be tested. So we really end up moving to a situation like we see with seasonal flu, where our laboratory does testing, and that information is extremely useful to us in monitoring what's happening in sort of a 30,000 foot view, but it's not testing every single person. So we base that on that kind of a perspective. So recognizing that we're going to ramp up to a peak, and we're going to be getting, you know, lots of information, but then once we have widespread activity, our testing will go down. We want to keep doing it so we can monitor what's happening around the state, but it won't be every single case. But a good question, because it's clearly not enough if we had what was happening in China.
Yes. Thank you. And actually, you just answered a question for me, too, because I had kind of looked at the the money for the lab testing and thought, well, gee, you know, usually when a patient gets a lab test, it's paid for by their insurer or however they usually get their health care paid for. It makes sense here, though, for this to be a public health expense because it's not so much clinical information as it is information to help us monitor and control the spread of the disease. So that was kind of in my mind, and you just helped me answer that question. I just, as we move on to the hospital administration here, first of all, thank you very much for coming in today and giving us this detail. And I just want to emphasize for members, you know, please look at the fund language. And we will be, I think this may very well change before we actually pass a bill out of here as things evolve and, you know, maybe there will be more work done. I know the Senate is also carefully considering the request and what the needs might be, because one of my goals, and one of the members here mentioned it, is that this obviously has to be a plan that's going to take us through until the legislature reconvenes next January. The worst situation would be for there to be a pandemic and, you know, and then suddenly we're out of money and then the legislature has to come back in a special session to appropriate more funds. We want to avoid that. The fund that we have is set up for this very purpose, where there's an ability for the commissioner to tap the funds for particular reasons, and then the funds stay there. So if we were to over-appropriate, you know, say we don't need the money, we always have the opportunity to come back and right-size it when we come back in January, or leave it there if there's a need for ongoing. Obviously, this isn't only for COVID-19. There are other things could happen in the meantime as well. So thank you so much, Commissioner, Ms. Ayersman. Appreciate it. And now we're going to have Dr. Rahul Karani, who is the president of the Minnesota Hospital Association. Welcome, and thank you for waiting up there through this whole thing.
Oh, that was actually great, Madam Chair. Thank you. I stretched my legs and was able to get ready, so I appreciate it.
All right. Well, please introduce yourself for the record, and then we were hoping to hear from you, as you probably heard in the hearing here, not so much what hospitals need for resources, but kind of, you know, what happens with the hospital community when these kinds of things arise.
Great. So, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for having me here. You know, I want to begin by thanking Madam Chair and all of the representatives for the hard work that you do for Minnesotans. We truly appreciate it. And, you know, being 4 weeks into the job, this is a great training opportunity to have this conversation with you. So I'm Dr. Rahul Karani. I serve as the president and CEO of the Minnesota Hospital Association. For more than 20 years, I have been a physician here in Minnesota. I have cared for patients and held leadership positions at Minnesota's smallest critical access hospital in Starbuck, Minnesota, and at one of Minnesota's largest healthcare systems in the Twin Cities Metro. So I've worked with the care teams at the front lines as a primary care physician. And when it comes to infectious diseases and taking care of patients with infectious diseases, it's going to take the entire care team. It's going to take the nurse and the physician, the infectious disease specialist, the nursing assistant, the environmental professional, all of us together. And so I've been there, and I think we all should be very proud of what our healthcare system in Minnesota does. Over the past few weeks, Minnesota's healthcare systems have been working together to prepare our hospitals and clinics for patients and to support and protect our workforce during a coronavirus or COVID-19 outbreak. While COVID-19 is new, as you heard from Commissioner Malcolm, preparing for responses to disasters is not something new for Minnesota or for our hospitals and health systems. Emergency preparedness training is a year-round activity that is done within each facility, system, and region. Hospitals and clinics treat patients with a variety of infectious disease on a daily basis. We do this all the time. These patients are isolated, are treated in appropriate spaces by trained staff and care teams using specialized equipment. The Minnesota Hospital Association has been partnering with the Minnesota Department of Health, and you heard from the commissioner and Ms. Erisman, and we've been in continuous conversations with their teams. We are holding weekly information calls with our healthcare systems and healthcare stakeholders, which, by the way, includes post-acute care facilities, skilled nursing facilities, assisted living facilities, and places where Minnesotans gather. We thank MDH for their leadership, especially and particularly in the areas of public health, disease containment strategies, and their communication to the public. That is critical at this particular moment in time. Our hospitals and health systems will play a central role in response to an outbreak. Based upon our preliminary data, and I will share some data with you, we expect to care for approximately 15% of coronavirus patients who will likely need hospital-level care. And again, this is what the commissioner shared with you. And approximately 5% of coronavirus patients who will likely need to be treated in an intensive care unit or an ICU. So again, I want to draw for you the 80% of patients that can be treated at home. They call the clinic. They can be quarantined at home. But then there's the 20% of patients, and these are the numbers that we're getting from China and across the country, and we're learning more every day. 15% of patients will need acute care hospital. 5% will be the very sick, which will need intensive care unit. So part of the Minnesota Hospital Association's collective planning is trying to identify the needs so that our healthcare systems from clinics and hospitals and other parts of the care system can be prepared to treat a potential surge of patients. So hospitals and healthcare systems are working together with us, and I'm very proud of the work they've been doing over the last couple of days. I just want to draw your attention to what I've been hearing and what we've been hearing with input from hospitals and healthcare systems across the state. This is not just Metro and Greater Minnesota, and what our priority areas and needs might be to take care of this surge of patients. Additional ICU capacity and medical surgical bed capacity and isolation rooms may be needed if there's a surge. Obtaining scarce supplies, including personal protective equipment or PPE, which is critical. It's absolutely critical for protecting our healthcare staff who care for these patients at the front line. The care for our patients in our communities depends on our hospital and clinic staff and care teams. We want to ensure that our nurses, physicians, and many other professionals on the care teams have adequate PPE to keep them safe. The next point I want to bring to your attention is increasing staffing to meet patient needs, cover extended hours, and account for staff absences, because these staffs are moms and dads and caregivers too. So they may need to stay home to take care of their own kids or their parents. And then expanding bed capacity if needed, if we have a surge and serve Minnesotans. And then finally, specific training for healthcare staff across all settings, especially in the light of growing supply chain shortages, and you talked about that previously. I am pleased to know that testing for COVID-19 is finally available in Minnesota. Testing is absolutely critical, as we already heard, so that we can get a full picture of the prevalence of this disease right here in Minnesota. And we want to make sure that this testing becomes even more accessible in hospitals and clinics. Because this disease is an emerging disease, we are going to get new information by the hour. And so we will learn the number of potential patients that may need hospital level of care and ICU level of care. So we are learning every hour. But I do want to give you some data, and I think this is important data for you. According to estimates from Metro Emergency Preparedness Planners, Twin Cities metro area hospitals have approximately 5,000 total acute care beds and 500 total ICU beds. We are trying to find out the capacity across the state as we speak. There are approximately 450 total ventilators in the metro, but that can be expanded to a degree using some transport ventilators, anesthesia machines, or similar equipment. Again, we are working with MDH to try to get a statewide picture. According to the Metro Health and Medical Preparedness Coalition, and I think this is something that you should pay attention to, because you know this caught me not by surprise, because I'm a hospitalist, so I kind of see this right now, but I think these are important numbers. Within this past week, available capacity for adult ICU beds, medical surgical beds, non-critical monitored beds, and airborne isolation beds fell below 5% on one or more days in the Twin Cities Metro. That is available capacity for these beds. It is critically important for state policymakers like you all to understand the needs of our healthcare delivery system to deal most effectively with this contagious disease. State resources are going to be needed because we don't know how much would be forthcoming and when from the federal government. We urge the state legislature to swiftly provide supplemental emergency funding directly and specifically to support the urgent preparedness and response needs of Minnesota's hospitals, health systems, physicians, nurses, and our entire care teams that are going to be on the front lines taking care of Minnesotans that may be affected by this disease. This supplemental emergency funding request from Minnesota's hospitals and health systems is in addition to the other COVID-19 preparedness and response efforts the state is considering funding, including what you heard from Commissioner Malcolm, and as she said, including public health measures, surveillance, and testing and other efforts through MDH. Our hospitals and health systems will work hand in hand, and already are, with federal and state and local governmental partners to ensure safe care for Minnesotans, protect healthcare professionals and the entire care team of professionals who are providing direct patient care, and support the health and safety of our communities. Regardless of size or geography, so again, this is Greater Minnesota and Metro and all metros. So regardless of size or geography, our frontline care teams who will surround these patients need to have all the tools at our disposal to serve Minnesota and Minnesotans. Thank you for your consideration of our comments. We are standing ready to serve our communities. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Karani. We appreciate it. That's great. If that was your first time, that was fantastic.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your being here. I have a question from Representative Munson, if you can take some questions.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for the work you do. I think this is really important to make sure that we're prepared for anything if it does get severely worse. I think Representative Cantrell had mentioned earlier about the cost of treatment. And in my visit, when I was required to go to the HCMC by the Department of Health, I had a bill that was, this is 17 years ago, my bill was, I think, $1,100 to $1,400 for my visit. And I didn't ask for all these, you know, things. It was kind of like they just ushered me in there, and I had to travel to the metro to get this done. So I think there is a concern around some of the extra costs associated with testing if we're trying to weed people out that may have this infection. I saw there's an article that posted this morning that there's two individuals at the Minneapolis airport that are in quarantine because they've been in contact with a COVID-19 patient in Europe. And so I'm wondering, what is Minnesota's authority? Maybe this is more for Commissioner Malcolm. What is Minnesota's authority to work at with the airport? Because this is really a virus that's going to spread through traveling. Do we have the authority to set up stuff at the airport, or is that federal? Or is there coordination with the CDC and screening passengers, or maybe at other airports on their way here? What's the process for it? Maybe it's MDA.
Yeah, okay. Dr. Kahani, do you want to say something?
Yeah, I'll just showcase the partnership that we have with the Department of Health, Madam Chair, and Representative. You know, we have to make sure that we take care of 100% of Minnesotans that are affected by this disease. That's where public health response for the 80% comes in, and the commissioner, Chris Erisman, and so many of our team members are doing hard work daily over the weekend at night to take care of communication to the public, to take care of the portals of entry, to educate the public, schools, employers, many others. So that's for the 80%. What I was trying to bring your attention to, in addition to what the commissioner said, was what we must do and prepare for those Minnesotans that are going to end up in the hospital, and we need to make sure we provide the best care to them as well. But I'll let the commissioner answer your specific question as well.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative, actually the MSP does have a quarantine station that is staffed by CDC. So what happened with that plane and those returning students was under sort of federal direction. But it's a good example of kind of the measures that are being taken to try to identify potential exposures and contain them to the degree possible to again, as I said earlier, to try to slow down and smooth out the spread of the disease. But that specific instance is a CDC function, so the quarantine station is staffed by them.
Okay, and just follow up, Madam Chair.
All right, real quickly, Representative Watson.
To the doctor's question about the number of beds, I know that we had a presentation last year on how many times we've kind of maxed out the number of beds in capacity in the metro, but the bed numbers are in statute of how many can be allowed for each hospital, and there's been a lot of discussion around these banked beds from hospitals that are purchased, and then they bank the available beds, and I think the Department of Health, is it the Department of Health or just the legislature that sets those numbers, and so we can't just, I mean, no. I would support getting rid of all of these restrictions, but it's the number of beds that.
Representative Munson, let's not open that particular can of worms right now. We had a hearing on that just recently where we discussed that, and I think we all agree that some work needs to be done around that, but it's really a whole complicated thing.
Okay.
So, Representative Halverson.
Madam Chair, and I understand that we're at the end of our committee hearing, but I think that we need to take this opportunity to say thank you to everybody who is putting themselves on the front lines. Thank you, Doctor, for the work that you're doing. Thank you to the nurses. Thank you to the physicians. Thank you to the people, housekeeping, who are cleaning these suites. Thank you to the people who are checking us in and getting to where we need to go. We really appreciate it, and so please share my thanks, and I'll speak on behalf of the committee. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Quick question. So are health plans required to reimburse if a patient is sent to a non-network facility or hospital for testing or for quarantine? And second, I'm concerned about staffing shortages, and how are hospitals working together to collaborate on a plan to share staff across the state if one area is hit harder than another area?
So, Dr. Karani, I don't know if you're going to be able to answer that first thing, but maybe the second one.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Schultz. So the first question, I think, you know, other experts who have more knowledge about how that all works can answer that. Absolutely, I want to assure you that the hospitals and the healthcare systems, which includes the clinics and the skilled nursing facilities and our outreach efforts through telemedicine so people can stay home, we are working together. That is the mission of the Minnesota Hospital Association. You know, I've talked to almost all the CEOs over the last 3 days, and I know, and you should be assured, they're working very hard in your communities across the state. So absolutely, we are coordinating efforts, and as I already said, we are coordinating with the MDH as well. So please be assured that we are trying very hard to coordinate.
Thank you. And members, there are other letters in your packet as well, if you would look through and make sure that you see those. And I just, you know, in closing, we will continue this discussion, of course, and thank you, Dr. Karani, for coming in and giving us that information. I just wanted to say that I really do think that we are fortunate here in Minnesota. We've heard that from several members, and at the same time that we need to be vigilant, put some resources forward, and make sure that we contain any, you know, that we protect Minnesotans to the greatest degree possible, I think we can be very proud of the fact that we have a really good system here. We have really good work between our medical community, our public health community. We're in a really good place because of the previous resources and the previous care with which our system has been built. So I think we can be really feel, I would say, cautiously optimistic. Isn't that the nice term that people like to use about, you know, that we're going to be able to get ahead of this thing and really do a really good job keeping Minnesotans safe. So thank you very much, members. We are adjourned.
Thank you.